the headlines, Iran says it has developed a highly maneuverable hypersonic missile that can penetrate the most advanced air defense systems. Russia says it has begun withdrawing its troops from Kherson one day after announcing a pullback from the west bank of the Dnieper River. Plus, millions of commuters in Paris and in London are facing travel chaos as striking workers bring subway services to a halt. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is the news. Thanks for joining us. Iran says it has developed a hypersonic missile with the power to counter highly advanced defense systems.
We have developed an advanced hypersonic missile which is capable of penetrating air defense shields. This missile system has a high speed and extreme maneuverability and can operate both within and above the Earth's atmosphere.
The general also admitted that the system represents a generational leap in the field of missiles. The commander said the new hypersonic missile will maintain its competitive advantage and technological edge for the decades to come. Iranian military experts have in recent years made substantial headway in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, attaining self-sufficiency in the arms sphere. Iranian officials have repeatedly said the country will continue to strengthen its military capabilities, including its missile power, which are entirely meant for defense. Iran's new version of indigenously made missile defense system, Bavar 373, is capable of hitting targets just 5 minutes after fire. As Salman Khoury reports, the missile system has made Iran among only five countries in the world with such a highly sophisticated technology.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them and engaging with six concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into three main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only four or five countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships. The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs three different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Salman Khoury, Tehran.
The Russian army says it has begun pulling its forces back from Ukraine's southern city of Kherson, which Moscow has had under control since the early days of the war.
The units of the Russian troops are maneuvering to prepared positions on the left bank of the Dnipro River in strict accordance with the approved plan.
Russia announced its decision to withdraw its forces from the west bank of the Dnipro River on Wednesday. Moscow says the move is aimed at saving the lives of Russian soldiers and their fighting capacity. Ukraine claims that its forces have recaptured 12 towns and villages in the strategic region of Kherson since Wednesday. Kyiv also says that it has reclaimed the southern town of Snihurivka, the last remaining Russian-held town in the Mykolaiv region. Meanwhile, the NATO chief says the Western military alliance will support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Stoltenberg says the, quote, unprecedented support is vital for the Ukrainian progress on the battleground. Commuters in Paris are facing travel chaos as metro workers go on a strike to demand higher pay and job security. Transport officials in the French capital say that nearly every metro line will be shut down or operating with only limited rush hour service. Union leaders are hoping to step up pressure on the government to reconsider the revival of a controversial pensions overhaul that would push back the retirement age by 3 years. Also, workers across several sectors in recent weeks have staged strikes seeking pay hikes or increased hiring. Similarly, other parts of Europe are seeing workers halt work to show their anger at soaring prices. Well, not only in Paris, but also in London, railway workers are demonstrating their discontent with their pay and working conditions. They've staged another large-scale industrial action. A strike by the London Underground staff is paralyzing public transport and stranding millions of travelers. A correspondent in the British capital, Said Pourreza, joined us earlier to tell us more about the strike.
The government, of course, has been saying that the unions, the railway workers, will have to get used to modernization, modernized practices, and they want more incorporation of Sundays, for example, into the working week. On the other hand, the unions are saying, look, they don't have any problems with modernization, but what they want is to protect those 600 jobs that might be lost to modernization, and that the government will have to find ways to come up with the money that they're asking in terms of pay rises that they haven't received in a very long time, citing examples of how train company bosses, executives, are making away with millions, if not billions, over the past few years. And of course, passenger levels are still at pre-pandemic levels. Revenue is not as much as used to be. That's the claim, of course, by the government. The unions tend to disagree with that. But this is more than just the railway industry, Bardia. Across the different sectors, strikes have either been held or are planned to be held over the coming months. The most recent one that we heard about was a vote by nurses to go on strike for the first time in more than a century. That, of course, is yet to be determined. The exact date, we're not aware of it just yet, but that is going to happen. And unless there is a breakthrough in these negotiations between the unions and the government, we're going to see more of similar action taking place, industrial campaign to go on. And that's the promise that the unions have given, that they will continue with their industrial campaign as long as it takes until they get what they are demanding.
France says that it will allow a rescue ship transporting over 200 migrants to dock at its southern coast. The French government harshly criticized Italy for failing to take in the migrants. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin denounced Italy's ban on the boat as, quote, incomprehensible and selfish. He said that France would make up for this unacceptable behavior. The French minister said that Italy's approach will lead to extremely strong consequences on bilateral relations. Darmanin said that France has suspended a plan to relocate 3,500 migrants currently in Italy in protest against Rome's refusal to take in the ship. This is the latest European standoff over where to disembark migrants picked up after trying to reach Europe from North Africa. Italy has been increasingly frustrated with taking in the bulk of those rescued. Rome says other states, including France, must do more. The senior Bahraini cleric is doubling down on his call for a boycott of parliamentary and municipal elections. In a tweet, Shia leader Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmad Qassem said the elections will kill democracy in Bahrain. He lashed out at those who claim the vote is aimed at reinforcing democracy. The top religious figure reiterated that the elections are actually meant to destroy democracy as they are off-limits to those who are really seeking democracy. He noted that Bahrain's elections are in fact geared to promote dictatorship and that people are only pawns for the regime to dominate. The elections are scheduled for the 12th of November. Yemen's Ansarullah fighters and allied army units have thwarted yet another attempt by the Saudi-led coalition to steal oil from the country's energy-rich province of Shabwa. They've staged an operation against an oil ship in the port of Kenya. We earlier talked to our correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Nauri, to hear it all.
Well, this is a port that's actually stationed in an area under the control of the Saudi-led coalition. And since 2015, since the war started, the Saudi-led coalition and the sponsoring states have basically been looting Yemeni oil and Yemeni gas from this province illegally. This is the province of Shabwa. And we're talking about millions, if not billions, of dollars under the supervision of the United Nations. However, until recently, as recent as last month, the Yemen Salvation Government is basically saying enough is enough. They're going to take matters into their own hand and protect Yemen's natural resources. And this is actually the second thwarted attempt by the Saudi-led coalition and their contractors to steal Yemeni oil from oil-rich provinces in Yemen. And this was another warning message sent by Yemen's armed forces, which basically sent and launched another drone strike near in the proximity of the port to send a message to this illegal oil ship that if they don't turn back, they're going to be targeted. And fortunately for this crew, they got the message. They turned back empty-handed.
A number of Palestinian rights groups have slammed Israel for its decision to outlaw them as terrorist organizations, followed by closure orders and raids on their offices. The head of one of the rights bodies told UN investigators that the regime's move was like an execution designed to stop them from probing abuses.
A United Nations Independent Commission of Inquiry has begun public hearings on the human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. Israel has harshly criticized the hearings while refusing to cooperate with the team. One of the subjects of the rare public hearings is Tel Aviv's designation of six Palestinian rights groups as terrorist organizations, followed by closure orders and raids on their offices last year. The move targeted such NGOs as Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, the legal aid human rights group Al-Haq, Defense for Children International Palestine, Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bissan Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The heads of three of the rights bodies took to the floor saying Israel had justified the move with a secret file and had provided no real evidence against them. The head of Al-Haq Rights Group told the UN investigators that Tel Aviv's designation of Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist bodies was like an execution designed to stop them from probing abuses by Israel. This could be referring to Israel's long-time exception from accountability before the UN and other international organizations, despite the regime's deadly atrocities against Palestinians. The head of Al-Haq Rights Group also described the designation and subsequent closure of NGOs as an arbitrary decision, saying Israeli forces had used mafia methods against them. Meanwhile, director of Adamir Prisoner Advocacy Group said a systematic attack against the human rights defenders is ongoing by Israel. The hearings, which have been harshly criticized by Israel, will also address the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was shot in the head by Israeli forces while on assignment in the occupied West Bank in May.
Israel has for decades been documented killing and maiming journalists. Shirin Abu Akleh is the latest in a long list of Palestinian reporters killed by Israeli forces. Israeli authorities have led an unprecedented crackdown on journalists attempting to cover the regime's crimes against Palestinians.
Leading human rights groups have equated Israeli policies against Palestinians to apartheid, and Palestinians have slammed the regime's move to designate human rights groups as terrorist organizations, saying the move is an unlawful decision and a flagrant violation of international law. However, the Israeli regime's efforts to silence and prevent the factual press image from being conveyed to the world are continuing unabated. The UN and Committee to Protect Journalists have documented 17 Palestinian reporters being killed since 2000. This does not include Shirin Abu Akleh or several other journalists killed from other countries, including two Italians, one Turk, and a Welshman. However, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate says the number is far higher. Israeli forces have beaten and fired live ammunition on reporters covering the unfolding on events in the occupied territories. Additionally, Israeli airstrikes on Gaza destroyed a building that housed a number of media offices during the bombardment of Gaza last year, rejecting a probe into human rights violations, killing and maiming reporters, and destroying media headquarters. Aren't these enough reasons to prove Israel is guilty of committing heinous crimes, but it's still trying to hide them?
The non-stop years-long use of pellet weapons to quell anti-India protests in India-administered Kashmir is taking its toll on the victims, especially those who were hit in the eyes. Our correspondent Shana Butt reports.
A recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight. Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak about his condition was no less than a Herculean task. Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory. Meanwhile, analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Butt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Experts have warned that excessive economic aid of the European Union to Ukraine will cause some financial crisis for the European Union and may even result in its disintegration. High inflation, energy crisis, and weak economic growth have made many economic experts to compare the current situation in Europe with the oil crisis of the 1970s. While European countries and the United States expect to defeat Russia in Ukraine war with sanctions policies, now they're caught in a severe economic crisis of their own. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC writes, Citi analysts said the euro area is at risk of a financial meltdown on the same scale as the crisis it suffered a decade ago. According to a report, Wall Street bank analysts have raised concerns about the violent bond market moves and the European government's plans to borrow vast sums of money. They say the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's relief package, worth 200 billion euros, and aimed at tackling soaring energy prices, may soften the coming recession, but also poses risks for Europe. Those risks relate to the question of how the package will be financed and what that could do to inflation, to Germany's sovereign bond yields, to the European Central Bank's benchmark rate, and to the borrowing plans of other euro nations that may do the same. Citing Britain's recent bond market meltdown after unfunded tax cuts by the government, Christian Schultz, deputy chief European economist at Citi, told CNBC, "The risk is that others may follow that example." Christian Schultz explained that Germany could afford any debt financing thanks to its low debt-to-GDP ratio and lower external funding needs. But the package could open a door for less fiscally prudent countries to want to borrow large amounts of money and issue new debt. That could potentially lead to trouble, like we have seen in Britain. Citi analysts forecast that German debt financing could force tighter European Central Bank policy, which could also send yields surging in the euro area. Christian Schultz warned, "The risk is that this same dynamic, as we have seen in Britain, evolves on the European continent as well." Meanwhile, data by Saxo Bank shows that a European Central Bank stress indicator for the Eurozone's financial system, which looks at tensions in bond, equity and money markets, has risen from below 0.1 at the start of the year to almost 0.5 now. During the Eurozone debt crisis in 2009-2010, the index exceeded 0.6. Russia Today explains more about the same story. European Central Bank Chief Christine Lagarde revealed recently that Europe is facing lower-than-expected economic growth as inflation continues to climb in Europe, explaining that the European Central Bank had raised interest rates by 0.75 basis points in an attempt to control soaring prices. Speaking before the European Parliament's Committee on Economic and Monetary Affairs recently, Christine Lagarde admitted that inflation remains far too high and is likely to stay above our target for an extended period of time. The former International Monetary Fund boss, Christine Lagarde, warned that the economic consequences for the euro area of Russia's conflict in Ukraine had spiraled further since June, a reference to Western sanctions on Russian oil and gas, which have sent fuel prices skyrocketing. She said, "The outlook is darkening." While the Eurozone's economy grew 0.8% in the second quarter of this year, Christine Lagarde said The European Central Bank expected activity to slow substantially over the rest of 2022 to a total of 3.1% over a year and a mere 0.9% for all of 2023. She claimed things would improve marginally in 2024, with economic growth projected at 1.9%, while noting a decline in global demand due to what she called the worsening terms of trade. Christine Lagarde said much of this quarter's economic growth was due to strong consumer spending driven by reopening of COVID-shuttered industries like tourism. She said high inflation is being reinforced by gas supply disruptions, adding that uncertainty and falling household and business confidence were also contributing to the bleak predictions. Inflation hit 9.1% in the month of August, driven by energy and food prices. The European Central Bank has hiked its inflation projections accordingly, setting 8.1% for 2022, 5.5% for 2023, and 2.3% for 2024, with Christine Lagarde pointing the finger again at major disruptions in energy supplies. The central bank's recent 0.75 percentage point interest rate increase earlier this month was only the second hike in 11 years, after it added 50 basis points in July. Christine Lagarde said the increase would dampen demand but ensure that inflation expectations remain well anchored. Lagarde admitted the situation is expected to get worse before it gets any better, with regard to high energy and high food costs, the most important issues for 2 out of 3 Europeans right now. However, she urged governments to make sure fiscal support for the most vulnerable households were temporary and targeted so as not to exacerbate inflationary pressures. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has more on the same story. The European Union Statistical Office warned recently over 95.4 million people, every fifth EU citizen, were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2021. According to the latest data revealed by Eurostat, 21.7% of the European bloc's population lived last year in a household that experiences at least one of the three main risks of poverty: severe social and material deprivation, or very low work intensity. The number is slightly higher compared to 2020, when 94.8 million people, representing 21.6% of the European Union's population, faced similar difficulties. The statement explained, in total, 73.7 million people in the European Union were at risk of poverty, while 27.0 million were severely, materially and socially deprived, and 29.3 million lived in a household with low work intensity. Some 5.9 million people, or 1.3% of the EU's population, simultaneously experienced all of the three risk factors. Among the 27 European Union member states, Romania has the highest share of the population, 34%, facing poverty and exclusion. This was followed by Bulgaria, with 32% of the population facing poverty and exclusion. Greece and Spain, both with 28% of their people at risk, were in third and fourth positions. Meanwhile, the Czech Republic, Slovenia and Finland recorded the lowest shares of the population in deprivation, with 11%, 13% and 14% respectively.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. When you look at historically, you look at three major events in Islamic history. One, of course, was the establishment of Islam by the Prophet of Allah in Mecca and Medina. One, of course, was this commemoration, the days of Ashura. And one will be the arrival of our Imam. And the one common denominator in all three of them are the young. The Prophet of Allah would give very difficult responsibilities to young people. And back then, and it still kind of holds true today, back then the culture was, if you were older, a little bit of whiteness in your beard, you were wiser. If you were younger, you were a little bit foolish. And you couldn't be trusted. Right? So the known sort of custom was that if you need something done properly, you have to ask the elders. It shows that there is this a little bit of trust they have towards the youth. Back then, the Prophet, monumental tasks. The first tabligh mission to Abyssinia, Ja'far, 80 plus people. That's a difficult mission to do. Ja'far in his early 20s. Bilal Habashi, first Mu'addin in Mecca, drive the Arabs crazy. Couldn't say seen or sheen. 18 years old, climbing the Kaaba, giving the Adhan. Amir al-Mu'mineen, up and down all these great wars and these great Zulfiqar stories that we love to hear, warms our heart. All of that, from Badr to Khaybar to Khandaq, all in his 20s. Ghadir, 33 years old. Mus'ab was only 19 years old. Mus'ab was that young man who went to Yathrib and converted the Khazraj and Aus tribes to Muslim, to Islam. Wrote the letter to the Prophet saying, these people are ready for your migration to Medina. The first Salatul Jama'ah in Yathrib before Medina was led by Mus'ab. Mus'ab was only 19 years old. And the Prophet time and time again would say, I'm not concerned about the year that you were born. I'm concerned about the state of your heart. These were young individuals, monumental in establishing Islam and bringing it to its success, like I said yesterday, at a time that was almost unheard of across 23 years. Come to Karbala, the exact same thing. These amazing shahada were all young, and the approach to them was, there was no hesitation, there was no fear. In fact, there was a little bit of rebellious if Imam Hussein ever suggested that you're not going to go and sacrifice your life. And the mission of our Imam will be no different. The point I'm trying to make is that through the lens of the deen, at least, there's something about the jewel of a youth that they see. So what I'm asking all of you to do is difficult. It's not easy. But if anybody can do it, it's my young. When you settle, it bothers me. When you convince yourself I can't do it, it bothers me. When you sell all that iman out for the sake of a couple of this and that, it bothers me. That's not who you are. You're above that. You're better than that. You've been raised by these amazing parents in front of me, better than that. And there'll come a moment, if not already, where you'll be asked now to deliver on that tarbiyat. Because my parents all the time now, they'll call me and you know, they'll cry and they'll complain and they'll, you know, kakaring it, what's going to happen? And when I asked him, how old is your son? He's 32 years old. I go, he's not a son. He's done. That's it. He's a grown man. You've done your part. Now just do dua. You're a mother, inshallah, it'll be qabool faster. But you've done your part. Now trust that tarbiyat. Because when we go to establish anything that is remotely spiritual, part of that process is to understand the barriers. those impeding factors that are there flat out to stop us from reaching our spiritual goals. Absolutely. And sometimes it's in our families, sometimes it's in our circle of friends, and sometimes it is the whisperings of shaitan inside of us. Inside of the discussion on racism, when you look at, for example, the idea of internalized racism inside the African-American community, there's even a further discussion on the shade of black that you are. And the darker your skin is, the more racist or more racism you'll feel. The lighter skinned ones don't face as much. So now to the point now where this internalized racism is based on a color scale, a palette almost. That if my skin is dark, I have to now increase that racism. If I'm a little bit lighter, same idea. Where there it's color, here it's spirituality. So I'll just do enough to say, okay, you know what? I'm not that bad. I'll just keep my beard a little bit light. I'll just move my hijab 1 inch above. That way I'm still covered, but I have my bangs to show it. I'll move my pants just a little bit up to show my ankles and have a nice little jewelry around my ankle. Just enough to say, look, you know what? I'm not crazy. I'm good. Right? Levels of piety. Or I'll convince myself, or I'll blame others that, look, you know what? Like Shaitan did, فَبِمَا أَغْوَيْتَنِي. I'll sit there and say, you know what? I do this, for example, because everyone else does it. You know how many times, and this is very unfortunate, I'm sorry for bringing it up on a member, when I talk to couples, and I'm in no way am I a counselor. I'm not even close to it. I lend an ear, that's all I do. Sometimes when I talk to couples, what's becoming more and more common and just accepted is adultery. Just accepted. In terms of sense, well, you know, like what is it that he's doing? Is he with other women? Yeah, that's he's been doing for years. Whatever, I've accepted that. But he does this. Wait a second. What about this? How can that be accepted? Every day, common. Everyone's doing it. Right? You reach a point now where you get midlife crisis and you kind of, you know, one woman smiles at you the wrong way at work and that's it. That's all it takes for a man sometimes, right? How many times, you know, have I heard that my dad has a whiskey bar in the basement? Apne shia log. No, Malana. Yeah. And they say, look, I don't bring it to the house. I don't get drunk. When I have a long day, I have one glass and that's it, right? That's the levels of spirituality. You kind of, you know, blur those lines. It's all internalized Islamophobia, all of it, internalized. I'm tired of blaming this ism and that ism and this ism. Let's begin to look inwards. That's what I'm tired of. It's their fault, it's their fault. Yes, they will do what they do best. They will pour in money and they will have all sorts of now, you know, different groups and different active groups that are there to dismantle this sense of spirituality. Fine. They will do what they want to do. Why are you succumbing to all this? And the Quran now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, some of these verses are very, very firm. And I love God's firmness. Sometimes he shows a side of him, and I'm like, yes, that's my creator. Oh, I love it. The confidence, the strength, the might. Like he presents himself as untouchable sometimes. I want to what? I want to hang on to, I want to jump on that bandwagon. I want that confidence.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyim محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Economic recession and inflation, high cost of living and poor performance of the government all means that the British people are facing difficulties with their current living conditions. This has prompted labour unions, students, nurses and young people to go on strike against the current situation. The British protesters say it's all the result of more than a decade of Conservative rule. And the time has come for a change. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Forbes magazine has more for us. Britain's beleaguered health services face yet another blow as the country's main nursing union looks to have voted in favour of industrial action. The Royal College of Nursing asked its 300,000 members to strike over pay in a ballot that ended recently. Although official results have not yet been announced, sources have told several UK publications nurses have largely agreed to the industrial action. If a strike goes ahead, it will be the first ever walkout of its kind. The move would put extra pressure on already intensely overstretched health services, exacerbating twin crises in emergency and non-urgent care. As hospitals struggle to get on top of lengthy waiting lists, a strike would likely lead to further cancellations of appointments. But union leaders say nurses in emergency care would continue to work if industrial action goes ahead. This includes those working in life-preserving services like critical care, continuing therapeutic care, and urgent diagnostics. The Royal College of Nursing wants to strike over what it argues are inadequate pay rises offered by the government earlier this year. Union leaders argue the rising cost of living in the United Kingdom dwarfs the salary boosts offered to nurses who have endured extremely challenging working conditions throughout the pandemic. The government says that a nurse's average basic salary would rise from roughly £35,600 to £37,000 from March of this year. This is an increase of about 4%. But union leaders have asked for a much larger increase that takes into account soaring levels of inflation. They want a pay rise of 5% above inflation, which currently stands at around 13%. Union leaders say pay increases are needed not just to help nurses battle the cost of living crisis, but to make the overall workforce itself more resilient. Britain's hospitals are seriously understaffed, with tens of thousands of nursing vacancies currently unfilled. Other major health unions, including Unison, are also considering industrial action over pay. The Royal College of Nursing General Secretary and Chief Executive, Pat Cullen, said in a statement, "Patients are at great risk when there aren't enough nurses. Huge numbers of staff, both experienced and newer recruits, are deciding they cannot see a future in the nursing profession and that is not valued nor treated fairly. Our strike action will be as much for patients as it is for nurses. We have their support in doing this. As we begin industrial action, politicians in every part of the United Kingdom will be challenged to back their nursing staff and understand the strength of public support. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said on Tuesday, 8th of November, over 70,000 university staff will go on strike action in the coming days over pay, working conditions and pensions. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said the strikes will be held on 24th, 25th and 30th of November, with staff at 150 universities across the United Kingdom taking part in the walkouts. The University and College Union General Secretary Joe Grady said in a statement on the union's website, "Campuses across the United Kingdom about to experience strike action on a scale never seen before." Joe Grady noted, 70,000 staff will walk out and make clear they refuse to accept falling pay, cuts to pensions and insecure employment. This is not a dispute about affordability, it is about choices. Vice-chancellors are choosing to pay themselves hundreds of thousands of pounds whilst forcing our members onto low-paid and insecure contracts that leave some using food banks. They choose to hold billions in surpluses while slashing staff pensions. The strikes are expected to lead to the cancellation of lectures and disruption to courses for nearly 2.5 million university students. However, the union said disruption can be avoided if employers act fast and make improved offers. If they don't, strike action will escalate in the new year alongside a marking and assessment boycott. The University and College Union demands a pay rise due to the cost of living crisis, following the offer of a pay increase starting at 3% and an end to insecure contracts. The union also wants a reversal of cuts to sector pensions imposed this year, which it says will see the average member lose around 35% from future retirement income. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. According to the City Watchdog, which said a growing proportion of the UK's population is having trouble making ends meet, millions of people are also struggling to pay their bills. A survey by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, laid bare the impact of the cost of living crisis in Britain, saying about 1 in 4 or 24% of adults in the United Kingdom were either in financial difficulty or would fall into trouble if they suffered a financial shock. The Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, found that about 7.8 million people were finding it a heavy burden to keep up with their bills, an increase of about 2.5 million people since 2020, as wage growth failed to keep pace with soaring inflation, which is currently at a 40-year high, currently at 10.1%. Meanwhile, 4.2 million people had missed bills or loan payments in the 6 months before the survey took place, in the 4 months between February and June of this year. The financial challenges were concentrated in more deprived areas across the United Kingdom, with people in economically challenged regions roughly 7 times more likely to be in financial difficulty than their peers elsewhere. About 12% of people in the northeast of England and 10% in the northwest of England were struggling financially, compared with 6% of people in the southeast of England and in the southwest of England. The statistics were gathered as part of the FCA's Financial Lives Survey, which polled more than 19,000 people and will be published in full in early 2023. The government is believed to be considering raising benefits in line with wage growth of 5.5% rather than inflation, which would put further pressure on already struggling households. The Resolution Foundation think tank has said it would have stark consequences for families, with a single disabled adult on universal credit likely to lose £380, while a working single parent with one child would lose £478 a year. A working couple with three children would lose £978 a year. Sheldon Mills, a director overseeing consumer and competition issues at the Financial Conduct Authority, said, "Our research shows that people up and down the country are struggling to keep up with their bills. If you're facing financial difficulty, you do not need to struggle alone. There is free debt advice available, and we have told firms they must work with their customers to solve any problems with payments."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. In any case, it is over the course of many long years that the enemies have been working on the minds of the Muslims so that they say that Islam is not action. Faith requires no work. As long as there is love and faith and belief in your heart, there is nothing else you need to do. You don't need to move, to strive, to have an effect. It is years that they have been trying to convince of this. But what does the Quran say? It says loud and clear that they do not have faith. The Quran, Surah 24, verse 47. Those people who do not do what these verses describe, which we will continue to discuss tomorrow as well, are not believers. The faithful are those people who are with you, those people who are surrounded by Allah's grace, brotherhood, and submission, who are striving in the way of Allah in a way that befits their beliefs. They strive, they take action. This is the logic of the Quran. O you who have faith, bow down and prostrate yourselves and worship your Lord and do good so that you may be felicitous. The Quran, Surah 22, verse 77.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you do these actions, you will be successful, happy, and saved. But if you had faith without bowing, prostrating, worshipping Allah, or doing good, then will you be successful and happy? You can clearly see what the answer is. And strive for the sake of Allah, a striving that is worthy of Him. He has chosen you. The Quran, Surah 22, verse 78. It is He who has chosen you, O community of Islam. What does it mean when the Quran says He has chosen you? Does it mean you have been set aside like precious pearls, that you are cut from different cloth? They sin, they err, they disobey our commands, and paradise has their name on it? This is what the Jews claimed at the time of the Prophet. They made the same mistake. Every Muslim has the same mistaken idea in their head. The Quran responds to the Jews who believed themselves to be God's chosen and beloved, or in fact the sons of God, by delivering a very sharp rebuke. It says that the chosen and beloved of God are those who obey His commands. Yes, O children of Israel, we chose you. God chose the nation of Islam, but before Islam He chose the Israelites. But both acts of choosing are one and the same. In other words, God chose the people best prepared for His most important mission.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.